Now, let's join the crowd at Pitt Street Uniting Church in Sydney as John Dominic Crossan introduces the Good Samaritan and the power of parable.
I want to think about the Good Samaritan. And in one sense, I'm going back to where I was in the late 60s when I first began to work on the historical Jesus. Is the neighbor the recipient or the actant? I felt there was something funny there. And in one sense, it was unraveling that led a long, long way towards the historical Jesus. Let me begin then with the Good Samaritan. I'm going to begin with Augustine. I want to look at Augustine as a master exegete, what he does with the Good Samaritan. He interprets it, first of all, as a riddle parable. Then he interprets it as an example parable. And then he thinks about what he has done, seems a little bit diffident, and defends that it's all right to have it both ways. Let's watch. This is probably the most famous exegesis of the Good Samaritan ever made as a riddle parable or an allegory. In this case, it would mean that every single element in this story means something. All right, here's Augustine. The year is 399. It's in his Questions on the Gospel. A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Adam himself is meant. Jerusalem is the heavenly city of peace, from whose blessedness Adam fell. Jericho means the moon and signifies our mortality, because it is born, waxes, wanes, and dies. Thieves are the devil and his angels, who stripped him, namely of his immortality, and beat him. The priest and the Levite who saw him and passed by signified the priesthood and ministry of the Old Testament, which could profit nothing for salvation. That would certainly have surprised the Torah, the prophets, and God. Samaritan means guardian, and therefore the Lord himself is signified by this name. The binding of the wounds is the restraint of sin. Oil is the comfort of good hope. Wine the exhortation to work with fervent spirit. Now it gets a bit murky. The beast is the flesh in which Christ deigned to come to us. Being set upon the beast is belief in the incarnation of Christ. The inn is the church, where travelers are refreshed on the return from pilgrimage to their heavenly city. The morrow is after the resurrection of the Lord. The 2 pence, 2 denarii, are either the 2 precepts of love or the promise of this life and that which is to come. And now I love this one. The innkeeper is the Apostle Paul. Thank you for that, at least, Augustine. You've probably heard that. It's usually used as a horror example of bad exegesis. Now, I do think Augustine is having fun, exegetical fun. He's showing off a little bit about how clever he can be. Maybe by the end you think a bit too clever. But if you are imagining riddles, of course, that's how they work. Every part has to be explained. The 4 feet, the 3 feet, the 2 feet that we saw. So he goes through the whole thing. Now, hold on to that as one way of reading it. Here's a second one from the same Augustine. It's actually 2 years earlier, 397. It explains it as an example parable, and it also shows that Augustine is very much aware of that contradiction I saw in there. Is the neighbor the guy on the road or the guy in the ditch? Is the neighbor the one who receives help or the one who gives help? Augustine, now, this is on Christian Doctrine, some 2 years earlier, 397 the year. When the man to whom our Lord delivered these 2 commandments said, "Who is my neighbor?" he told him, summarizing, A certain man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho fell among thieves, severely wounded, left naked, half dead. Then he skips on. And he showed him that nobody was neighbor to this man except him who took pity upon him and came forward to relieve and care for him. So the man on the road is the neighbor, teaching us that he is our neighbor whom it is our duty to help, whence it follows that he whose duty it would be in turn to help us is our neighbor. So his brilliant solution is that the man on the road acts as neighbor, and therefore the man in the ditch then must pass it on, as it were. He sees the problem. For the name neighbor is relational, bilateral, and no one can be neighbor except to a neighbor. Everyone to whom he ought to show, or who ought to show to us, the office of mercy is by right called a neighbor. Now he's got both of them. He's got a quite brilliant, really, riddle explanation, and he's got an equally brilliant example explanation, and he solved the problem that neighbor is a relational term, so you act as a neighbor to somebody, and that person becomes a neighbor to others, and so it's a reciprocity. Then smack in the middle, right in the middle, chronologically, of these two interpretations, comes the confessions. 397 is the year which he gives the example parable. 399, he gives the riddle parable interpretation. 398, he writes his confessions. And it sounds to me very defensive. It's like he's a little bit embarrassed about what he's been doing, or somebody is poking him about it, more likely. What harm would be done if I should interpret the meaning of the sacred writer different from the way some other person interprets? Since many different things may be understood from these words, all of which may be true. Since each person tries to understand in the Holy Scripture what the writer understood, what harm is done if one person understands what you, capitalize, what you, the light of all truth-speaking minds, shows that person to be true, although the author read did not understand this aspect of the truth, even though he did understand the truth in a different meaning. It's one of the most furiously postmodern pieces of writing I've seen in a long time. And it is as tortuous as it sounds. Now the problem is, and I would say this with all due respect to Augustine, when you said in the Holy Scripture what the writer understood, that is normative. It is certainly possible that we may disagree, but again, we're not dealing with Rorschach. It's not that all of them are equally valid. I think we have to ask, in the parables of Jesus, what is Jesus up to? You notice the way I put that. What is Jesus up to is not quite the same as saying, what does this parable mean? What is Jesus up to in the parables? If we are right that the function of parables is to lure, seduce, provoke you into thought, into the raising of consciousness, then of course we still have to ask, raising of consciousness about what? So, before I turn to the Good Samaritan, what I really want to know is not how clever I am, but what is Jesus trying to say? That's what I really want to know. That's my discipline. I may get it wrong, that's absolutely possible, but that is what I will be doing. And I understand completely, and we all must understand, that when Jesus launches this out to his audience, the audience takes over. There is no point in reading an exegete who says, this is what it means. It means to have reaction from the audience. Let me quote you this before I proceed. This is from Lewis Carroll's novel, Through the Looking Glass. It's a famous foretaste of pre-modern thought. When I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. The question is, said Alice, whether you can make words mean so many different things. The question is, said Humpty Dumpty, which is to be the master, that's all. So what I'm trying to do is to make certain that Jesus is the master. The Good Samaritan. As a challenge parable. Now, I should have really by now totally prejudiced your minds that we've seen how challenge parables worked in the Old Testament with a good Moabite, with a good Edomite, as it were, with good Ninevites. As if, you know, in the ancient movies when I was growing up as a kid, cowboys and Indians. We all knew when we were playing, nobody wanted to be the Indian. Because we knew Indians were the bad guys or the guys who, and the cowboys were the good guys. We knew it. When you put it like this, it sounds stupid, we know that, but it operates at deeper levels, and that's why it's effective. Who in this audience, in this group, are its good guys? Who are its bad guys? Now, tell a story in which the good guys do bad and the bad guys do good. All of those words, good and bad, are in quotation marks. That's the structure of a challenge parable, which means, before I go on, that of course the priest and the Levite are not being in any way criticized, actually. If the audience in general doesn't take it for granted that priests and Levite are good guys, this whole thing fails. If this is sort of just cheap anti-clericalism, and everyone presumes that priests and Levites are bad guys, then it doesn't work. They have to be the guys whom you expect to do good. Now, in Luke, the story is in chapter 10. You have the opening when the lawyer asks Jesus about what must he do for eternal life. Then you have the parable of the Good Samaritan, and then you go back to the lawyer, and the last words are from Jesus are, go and do likewise. And in one sense, go and do likewise is almost the classical, traditional point of an example parable. First problem. Mark, as you know, is the major source for Matthew and Luke. Go to Mark chapter 12, and you find this is would be what we would call Tuesday of Holy Week, when Jesus is in the temple and there's a whole series of debates with him. And the first debate is about, let's call it marriage in heaven. Are there going to be marriage in heaven? The second one is the question of a lawyer about how do you get eternal life. The third question is about how can the Messiah be both David's son and David's Lord. They follow one after the other in Mark, 1, 2, 3. Matthew, following Mark, goes 1, 2, 3 in chapter 22. When you get to Luke on the Tuesday of Holy Week, he follows Mark in giving you this story about marriage in heaven, about the seven husbands, one wife, what's going to happen in heaven. Then he has nothing about the lawyer's question because he's already used it. He's already taken it from its Markan context in chapter 12 of Mark, moved it earlier to use it as a prelude and a framing prelude and postlude to the Good Samaritan. And then he goes right back to David's son and David's Lord. How is that possible? So you can actually show how Luke, following Mark in chapter 12 of Mark and 20 of Luke, has already taken a chunk of Mark up earlier and used it before his Good Samaritan. Now, this is crucial. Is the context of each parable, as you find it in Matthew, Mark, or Luke, to be taken as something that happened with Jesus? Can we look at Luke 10 and figure, once upon a time, a lawyer came up to Jesus and asked, and Good Samaritan and everything else? If it is, then that's a unit from the life of Jesus. Now, it's awfully hard, and please understand this. It's awfully hard because brilliant writers have put these things together not to think, this is really what happened. How can you read Mark 4 and not think, that's actually happened? Jesus is in the boat. Jesus talks to them this parable. Jesus explains it's to condemn them. Jesus takes the disciples aside and explains it to them. If you're trying to make a film, that's what you want. But we have to take the lawyer aside completely. You have to leave the lawyer aside and hear the parable as it runs, say, from, I think, 10, 30 to 35. That is terribly hard to do. Let me assure you of that. I've spent my life trying to do it. Luke is too good a writer to get out of him that easy. You have to try and take the parable out and try and imagine it shorn of its interpretation within the New Testament. Not because there's anything wrong with that interpretation, but because we're asking, is this what Jesus was doing? If Jesus told this story, beginning with, as it were, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and ending with paying 2 denarii, pay more when he comes back. End of story. Then we have to start imagining, what is the audience hearing? And what would the audience respond? And what is Jesus up to? Let me creep up on it this way. Supposing what Jesus wanted to say, if you find somebody in distress, you must always stop and help. Supposing that's the point. Jesus wants to give you an example parable to tell you, if you find somebody in distress, or imagine yourself in such a situation, help the person. He could have said, very easily, a person was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, fell among robbers, beaten, left for dead. A second traveler was going down that road, passed by. A third traveler, same road, passed by. But a fourth and final traveler saw the person in the ditch, stopped, and then you describe everything that happened. Now, I think if you had that, I think it would be perfectly valid, accurate, and even inevitable that somebody says that is an example parable. And it tells you, you should really stop and help the person in the ditch. And if Jesus told it like that, I think the audience would have got it. I don't think anyone would have said, got it, Rabbi. Stick with the majority. 2 pass by, 1 stops. Got it. Always stick with 2 out of 1. I would hope if somebody said that, somebody else in the audience would have said, nitwit. Because, for example, in that story, the people who pass by are paid no attention to. Everything concentrates and slows down into slow motion with the person who stops. And besides, everyone knows the ways of folklore. It's the third one that counts. 2 failures, every single person listening to that story would be waiting for the third one. All right, supposing Jesus just wanted some cheap anti-clericalism in his story, an example story. He could have said, person going down, a priest and a Levite pass by, and a final traveler stops and helps. And the audience would probably hear, we should do that. I wonder why he picked on our priests and our Levites. And maybe somebody in the audience would say, my brother's a Levite. He would have stopped. Why are you always picking on the priests? How do you know a priest wouldn't stop? It is tremendously easy to make an example parable if you don't put names on people. Let me do a third example. We're still probing Jesus' intention to do an example parable. A Samaritan is going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. A Samaritan is going down, gets beaten, left for dead in the ditch. The Samaritan's in the ditch. Priest passes by, Levite passes by, and a Jew stops and helps him. Now, try and imagine the audience. You've got a Samaritan in the ditch. The priest and the Levite pass by, but a Jewish layman, let's say, stops and helps. What would the audience do? I mean, they're being pushed a bit. They're being asked to listen to an example parable, which is bordering a little bit on a challenge parable. Would you really stop to help a Samaritan? Now, the audience probably would, I think, yeah, we should do it. Yeah, they wouldn't stop to help us, but we should do it. You're kind of massaging their morality a bit. And as long as it's a purely hypothetical case, sure we'd stop. Why then did Jesus do it the opposite way if he wants an example parable? Why put the Jew in the ditch and the Samaritan on the road? How can your audience go and do likewise? You've just told me a story, Jesus, and back now to the actual story. You've just told me a story, Jesus, in which, as it were, I'm in the ditch, and a Samaritan is going to help me. Now, on the one hand, I certainly want to be helped in that situation. But why did you have to pick on a Samaritan? What do you mean? That's where the full bite of the parable hits, and which it moves it out of example. Now, absolutely for sure and without any doubt, Jesus thinks you should stop and help somebody in a ditch. That's taken for granted. If that's not taken for granted, the whole thing doesn't work. If you think you shouldn't stop, then the whole thing's not going to work at all. Of course, it's a magnificent example parable. If it doesn't work on the level of an example parable of a beautiful person, it's not going to work at all as a challenge parable. But in this case, what they're asked to imagine is what is for us a cliché and which is for them an oxymoron, a good Samaritan. And there's not a person in this room, including myself, of course, for whom that's an emotional, visceral problem. What do we know about Samaritans and Jews in the first century? And we don't have to demonize anyone to understand it. Basically, the Assyrians had conquered the northern kingdom, transplanted it with their own people, so that somehow Jews and Samaritans were ethnic problems to one another. Were the Samaritans true Jews? Were the Jews true? Where were they stand? For example, here's what we know about them from history. What does the Bible tell us about Samaritans? Jesus sent messengers ahead of him. On their way, they entered the village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. But they did not receive him because his face was set towards Jerusalem. In other words, Jesus is traveling from Galilee straight through Samaria to Judea rather than crossing the Jordan and coming up the other side. The disciples, James and John, saw it. Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? He turned and rebuked them, went on to another village. You know the story in John 4. The Samaritan woman said to him, how is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria? And then John puts in parentheses, Jews do not share things in common with Samaritans. But especially, maybe the following story from Josephus's Jewish War. A great number of Jews were going up to Jerusalem to the Feast of Tabernacles this time. A certain Galilean was slain as the pilgrims passed through Samaria. Now, one person is slain. When the story reached Jerusalem, I'm quoting now, it put the multitude into disorder. They left the feast, and without any generals to conduct them, they marched with great violence to Samaria. It became almost like a little mini civil war. Rome had to intervene with the legionary troops from Syria and handed out crucifixions all over for both sides and sent the leaders on both sides to Rome for trial and to be beheaded eventually. So, Good Samaritan for us, as I said, is a cliche in the first century. It's an emotional, visceral challenge. I think this is where I see and saw most clearly the challenge parable of Jesus. Think of that one about Lazarus and the rich person. Because of the Latin, we sometimes call them dives, which is simply Latin for a rich person. It's a story about a very rich person and a very poor person. And nothing at all is said that the rich person has done anything wrong, and nothing at all is said that the poor person has done anything right. One is very, very rich, and the other is very poor and lives at the door of the rich person hoping for scraps of food. Now, don't rush for a moment into moral judgment. And what happens? The rich person, according to Jesus, goes to hell, to keep it simple. And the poor person goes to heaven. End of story from Jesus. You see the pattern. Imagine the audience. Wait a minute. What did the rich person do wrong? What did the poor person do right? Are you telling us, Jesus, that heaven and hell is simply an economic flip of the situation on earth with no moral tones whatsoever? Are you saying that the rich go to hell and the poor go to heaven and you get it on this earth or you don't get it in the next earth? What do you mean, Jesus? I think that's the challenge of that parable. You're asked to think about this world and the next. And what if the next world is simply the flip of this world? And I do not make any conclusions at all from that about what Jesus thinks about heaven and hell. Are you telling us, Jesus, that you either get it here or hereafter? Don't read into it. Don't presume that the rich man must have done something wrong and the poor man done something right. That's not told in the story. It's not the story of Nathan's parable, where the rich man has taken it from the poor man. Imagine the audience, and imagine that we don't know what would have happened. The publican and the Pharisee. Again, don't read Luke's interpretation. What's wrong with what the Pharisee says? He thanks God for not being a sinner. That's righteousness? No, it's not. He thanks God for not being a sinner. The publican, who's a tax collector in the classic sense, simply says, have mercy on me, a sinner. The audience might like to say, wait a minute, does he quit? What did the Pharisee do wrong? Pharisee is a good guy, tax collector is supposed to be the bad guy in the archetypal meanings. They do the opposite. Watch the number of parables in which, for Jesus, the expected good guys do bad, the expected bad guys do good, and try and imagine how the audience would respond, what it would have learned in responding to that.
On Sunday night on ABC Local Radio, we're listening to biblical scholar John Dominic Crossan speaking last year at Pitt Street Uniting Church in Sydney on the power of parable.
Just to remind us, the question we hear so often, what does the parable mean? I hope we now know that really doesn't help us. We have to try and imagine, what does the parable do? The best we can do is in the situation of Jesus, how are people liable to respond? That's what we're really after. So let me start with some examples. The vineyard workers. Kingdom of Heaven is like a landowner went out early in the morning. So he goes out, first of all, at 6 a.m., bring laborers into his vineyard. Now, before you go any farther, a Galilean audience is liable to have the hair rising a little bit on the back of their neck at this point. A vineyard is a high labor intensity, capital intensive operation. You're not going to get anything for a minimum of about 10 years, and then you might get nothing in any case if it doesn't produce good wine. So this is not your little peasant farm. This is a vineyard. We don't necessarily like vineyard owners, but there may be, of course, in the audience, some people who are in charge of vineyards. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them into the vineyard. He went out about 9 o'clock and saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And he said to them, you also go into the vineyard and I will pay you whatever is right. So he went out about noon, he went out about 3 p.m. and did the same. And about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around. And he said to them, why are you standing here idle all day? They said to him, I imagine between gritted teeth, because nobody hath hired us. He said to them, you also go into the vineyard. Evening came, 6 p.m. The owner of the vineyard says to the manager, call the laborers, give them their pay, beginning with the last, going to the first. Everyone gets a full day's pay, a silver denarius. And right away, we get this, the complaint. Those last worked only 1 hour, and you made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day, the scorching heat. He replied to one of them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do with what I choose with what belongs to me? Are you envious? Because I am generous. Now, please don't immediately rush to the presumption that obviously the vineyard owner must be God, or a symbol of God, or a metaphor for God, or a stand-in for God, because I doubt if most people in the first century would presume that. It's a vineyard owner. Why does he begin by saying he finds them standing idle in the marketplace? First of all, people don't stand, as you well know, in the Eastern marketplace. They sit and play dominoes or something, if they're being idle. They're standing in the marketplace to get work. They're not standing idle in the marketplace. And in case you missed it early, he comes back to it at 5 o'clock, they're standing around. And why are you standing here idle all day? Because no one has hired us. These are the provocations. Now, in my language, as I hear that, and I try and imagine the audience, if everyone focuses in, as we have done for 2,000 years, on whether this was fair, that this person gave everyone a full day's pay to show how generous, as it says, I am, despite the fact that everything up to that point has shown that this person's a cheapskate, actually. If that's the whole debate, I think the parable has been a dismal failure. If nobody says right early at 9 o'clock in the morning, they're not standing idle there, they're looking for work. What do you mean, Jesus, standing idle? Why did you put that in? In my language, this is an attempt to raise their consciousness on the difference between personal, individual, justice or injustice. Is this fair, what you and I are doing to one another? Valid question. Or something far more mysterious, harder to see, which we call structural or systemic justice and injustice. Isn't it marvelous how it all works out for the benefit of the owner, not the worker? And then you get the luxury of accusing the worker who spent the day looking for work of being idle. I think that's what Jesus is up to. Yeah, I'm risking that to say that. I think that's what Jesus is after. Otherwise, I can't really understand the provocations of insisting on standing and that these people are idle. They're looking for work. If nobody in the audience picks that up, then I think the parable has failed, because everything that has led up to that point has been attempting to provoke the audience into seeing systems. And systems are awfully hard to see. I think that's what it means to do. It is intended to provoke the audience, to force them to see the issue. Second example, and I am quite deliberately taking the ones where I think I can see clearly into what Jesus is trying to do. I call it the master's money. It's usually called the talents. The reason I'm not using the word talents is because I think that has become a sort of a red herring. We all have our talents. It's the metaphor of talents that has led us astray. God must be talking about the use of our talents. Matthew's version. This is an interesting one because we've a version in Matthew and a version in Luke. Matthew 25. A man going on a journey summons his slaves and trusts his property to them. 5 talents, 2 talents, 1. Now, a talent is a huge amount. It's something like 60,000 denarii. This is kind of almost unimaginable. All right. The one who received the 5 talents went off and made 5. The one who received the 2 made 2. The one who had received the 1 talent, the 3rd person, went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. Now try and imagine where you are in responding to this. The one who received the 5 came forward when the accounting was done. The master came back bringing 5. And notice the repetitive nature of what happens then. Master, you handed over to me 5. I've made another 5. Master said, well done, good and trustworthy slave. You've been trustworthy in a few things, I will put you in charge of many. Enter into the joy of your master. This is typical oral tradition. You repeat. The guy who has 2 talents comes up and you can almost know exactly what's going to happen. Master, you gave me 2. I got 2 more. His master said, well done, good and trustworthy servant. Dum to dum to dum. Exactly the same. And then comes the 1. Now, do remember, before we go any farther, that in classic folklore tradition, the 3rd one should be the successful one. The one who had received the 1 talent came forward saying, Master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not scatter seed. I was afraid. I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours. Master replied, you wicked and lazy slave. You knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, And on my return, I would have received what was my own with interest. In Greek, takos, the word we get token from. Take the talent from him and give it to the one with the 10 talents. Excuse me, Matthew, there was nobody with 10 talents, but let's leave that aside. Let me look at the parallel in Luke. And the point I want to make is, despite all the differences between the two versions, the key point is going to be exactly the same when you come to the one who produced only one, as it were. A nobleman went to a distant country to get royal power for himself and then return. Summoned 10 of his slaves. The numbers get all confused in the tradition, as you can see. Summoned 10 of his slaves, gave them 10 pounds. So each gets a pound, not the exaggeration of talents. Each gets a pound, do business with these until I come back. Then the next line goes back to the second type of parable about the nobleman. Citizens of his country hated him and sent the delegation after him, saying, "We do not want this man to rule over us." Anyway, having received royal power, he comes back. The first came forward, "Lord, your pound has made 10 pounds. So in this case, they start with one and get 10. You can imagine how all the numbers change as this parable is retold and retold. Second one came, "Your pound has made 5 pounds. But when you come to the third one, all of a sudden, Luke and Matthew hardly change a word. The other came saying, "Lord, here is your pound. I wrapped it up in a piece of cloth, for I was afraid of you, because you are a harsh man. You take what you did not deposit, and you reap what you did not sow. Master, I will judge you by your own words, you wicked slave. You knew, did you, I was a harsh man, taking what I did not deposit, reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money into the bank? When I returned, I would have received it with interest, takos." Now, what fascinated me when I compared those two is, despite all the diversity of numbers and everything else, when it comes to the key point, it's exactly the same. Now, how do we read this today with Wall Street as our background, or your equivalent down here? I think almost traditionally, the presumption is that the first two servants, our slaves, have done good, and the third one gets what he deserves. He's lazy. He hasn't done anything. Now, the question again is, how is the audience going to respond to Jesus in the first century? And how do I know what they're liable to say? Well, let me focus on the one word there, interest, takos, which is the only time in the entire New Testament it's ever used. And if we read this the way it's usually interpreted, then clearly, of course, takos is good stuff. The other two characters could not possibly have acquired that much without using this with interest. If they have gone into farming or something, they would not have produced anything like this for a far longer. They went into vineyards, for example. Takos. What does the biblical tradition think about takos? And again, I'm primarily interested in the audience. Has the audience been acculturated to the Roman system, where, of course, interest is perfectly normal, right, and good? Or do they know their own Jewish tradition, in which interest from a fellow Jew is absolutely forbidden in the Torah? It's taking advantage of somebody's trouble. From the three major law codes, Exodus and Deuteronomy and Leviticus, all agree. Exodus: if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you shall not deal with them as a creditor. You shall not exact interest from them. Exodus 22. Deuteronomy: you shall not charge interest on loans to another Israelite. Interest on money, interest on provisions, interest on anything that is lent. As we've seen, the whole thrust of the Torah is a sort of a desperate attempt to retain distributive justice, to stay one ahead of the normalcy of civilization. Leviticus: do not take interest in advance or otherwise make a profit from them, but fear your God. Let them live with you. You shall not lend them your money at interest, taken in advance, or provide them food at a profit. From the prophets: if one does not take advance or accrued interest, but withholds his hands from iniquity — so interest is iniquity — executes true justice between contending parties, he shall surely live. This is from Ezekiel at the time of the Babylonian exile. And it's repeated, repeated, repeated. If one takes advance or accrued interest, shall he then live? He shall not. He has done all these abominable things. You know, people want to go after abominations in the Bible. One of them is interest. Yeah, you know what I'm thinking of. He shall surely die. His blood shall be upon himself. If one withholds his hand from iniquity, takes no advance or accrued interest, observe my ordinances, he shall surely live. You take bribes, you shed blood, you take interest. And then this from the time of Jesus, from the fourth book of Maccabees, a book simultaneous, contemporary with Jesus. As soon as one adopts a way of life in accordance with the law, even though a lover of money, one is forced to act contrary to natural ways and to lend without interest to the needy and to cancel the debt when the seventh year arrives. Jesus tells the parable. Don't presume, and we shouldn't presume, which side Jesus is on necessarily. Leave that open for the moment. Your expectations, I know the hint, is that the third one is usually right. That's the standard law of folklore. But basically, the challenge to the audience is, are you with the Jewish God? Are you with the Roman God? And the Jewish tradition is, of course, you can't take interest. So the challenge of the parable is, who's your God? Are you with Rome? Are you with God? Are you with the Torah? Or with Roman custom? Do I know what happens? No. If everyone agrees that the last guy got what he deserved, and he should have done this, that, and the other, then I think the parable would have failed. If nobody in the audience says, yeah, but, you know, the Torah says. One third example, and then I go into a wider frame. I call it the least. I try to put titles on these that don't prejudice the interpretation. Not the wicked vineyard workers, but the least vineyard. Least, L-E-A-S-E-D. And again, a man planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, leased it to tenants. He sent a slave to get the produce. They seized him, beat him, sent him away empty-handed. Sent another slave to them, beat him over the head, insulted him. Sent another. This one they killed. Sent many others. Some they beat, others they killed. He still had one, a beloved son. He said, well, they'll respect my son. The tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. Seized him, killed him, threw him out of the vineyard. Now I'm going to stop there. That's, I think, where the parable ends. I stop there. I don't go into any metaphors that Jesus is the son who is killed or anything else, and that the others may be the prophets. That's perfectly valid interpretation of it. I imagine Jesus is stopping right there. Now he's presented them with a story. Don't presume which side he's on. What's the audience going to say? You know, good for them. Good for them. That's what we need around here. More people who'll kill these absentee landlords who send their messengers. But surely somebody else is going to say, that's really stupid. They're not going to get away with this. Do they really think that they can kill the son and they'll acquire the vineyard? So the whole question of violence, nonviolence, resistance, what to do about this, I think is going to come out, I think Jesus intends, from people listening to this parable. Once again, if everyone says, "Oh, this is awful," or if everyone agrees, "Whew, this is the way to go," then the parable hasn't worked. I think in the same way that the last one was to raise consciousness in terms of not interest so much as the Roman system against the Jewish system, to begin to glimpse systems and structures. What about violence? This connects clearly, of course, with my argument that what Jesus is about is nonviolent resistance to evil. I think the purpose of this is to raise people's consciousness, to start them talking about the whole problem of violence, how to handle Rome and everything else. And it's a terribly risky thing, right? It's terribly risky. What if everyone considers this to be an incitement to kill the landowners or something? So parables are dangerous. Let me leave those just three examples and try and go into a wider framework for a moment. What strikes me is this, is the strategy of Jesus is that on the one hand, the format of the parables is absolutely traditional. Not only traditional to Judaism, but traditional to the entire tradition of folklore throughout all the world when folklore folked. And yet, when you're kind of lulled into a security zone by the normalcy of the content, the format, then the content gets you. Of course, you're ready for the third one to be right. You know that with every story you've ever heard since you were a child. But then it's the Samaritan, or the one who doesn't go take for interest, who gets you. So let me tell you where I see this clearly. In 1909, a Danish thinker wrote a classic article called The Epic Laws of Folk Narrative. By laws, he meant across all of world folklore, cross-culturally, cross-temporally, there's certain things that keep coming up when people tell oral narratives. Now, they'll change from one to the other, but I'm focusing for the moment on how absolutely normal the format of Jesus is. And I'm using especially Ulrich's laws. He argues, for example, it's quite traditional to have a story that focuses just on one character. He calls it concentration on a leading character. Think of Jesus' stories. The rich fool, the treasure finder, the pearl buyer. And all of these may be articulated far more densely than we find in the little kind of couple of sentences we've heard. But you're focusing on one person, the tower builder, the king going to war, Luke 14, the sower. Remember the shepherd seeking the sheep, lost sheep, the housewife, all focusing on one character. That fits exactly into one of the laws. That simply means that any of these ones could have been expanded, as Jesus told it, beyond what we have there and luring the audience into it. The second law. He calls it the law of twins. Two characters in a story. In an oral tradition, you can't give people too dense a story if you want them to be able to hold on to it. Examples. The master and the steward in Luke 16. The widow and the judge, Luke 18. The sleeper and the one who knocks on the door, Luke 11. The Pharisee and the tax collector we mentioned. Lazarus and the rich man. Two characters. And pushing the folklore tradition to its maximum, three characters. And probably that's about it, these three main ones. And we've already seen that. The father, the prodigal son. The father and two sons. The priest, the Levite, the Samaritan. The three servants, the three guests who are too busy to come to the feast. Ulrich also mentions the law of repetition. The priest and the Levite who pass by are described in exactly the same language. A priest was going down on the road, he saw him, he passed by on the other side. A Levite, he came to the place, saw him, pass by on the other side. We've just seen the final servant-slave in the story of the master's money, Luke and Matthew. Despite all the other changes, they come very close to verbatim here. Ulrich talks about the law of three. When you have three characters or tests or trials, the first two will usually fail and the last one will usually succeed. He talks about the law of contrast. Nice, sharp polarizations between good, bad, ins, outs, haves, have-nots, successes, failures. Think of the two sons in Matthew 21, one who says yes and doesn't, one who says no and does, the wise and the foolish virgins. Then when you turn from that normalcy of format to the abnormality, shall we call it, of content, that is precisely what is so devastating in the technique of Jesus. If everything was sort of original and surprising, this wouldn't work. But for example, This is from an article on folklore and anthropology. Conclusion. Folklore serves to sanction the established beliefs, attitudes, and institutions, both sacred and secular, and it plays a vital role in the education in non-literate societies. Folklore does not attack the status quo. Are there any instances in folklore, the author asks, which suggest that the individual destroy or even disregard the institutions and conventions of their society? So on the one hand, Jesus is absolutely traditional with regard to the format of his stories and absolutely untraditional with regard to their function. They're challenging in the same way that Socrates challenged normalcy by asking questions, and Jesus challenged normalcy by telling parables, and both of them, of course, ended up quite dead. A more specific example. This is from a doctoral dissertation I read years ago by Hetty Jason. She had studied the stories collected from Near Eastern Jews who had emigrated to Israel from Muslim countries. Here's her conclusion. The religious leader is implicitly the representative of the supreme values of the society, and a questioning of his personal qualities or his right to leadership detracts from the validity of those values. There is not a single story in the whole Jewish Near Eastern material at our disposal which portrays the rabbi in a negative light or ridicules him, as on the contrary, the priest is frequently ridiculed in the Christian European tradition, or as even occasionally the rabbi is in Jewish European society. So apart from any individual parables, the strategy of Jesus is to present a format that everyone is kind of lulled into security. These are simply simple stories, and they seem to be following the format that we all expect, the laws of one, the laws of two, the laws of three, contrast between with others, patterning, all the standard stuff that you would find and they would know from their own tradition. But then something happens within that normal format that makes the content scary. Sure, the third one should be the right one. And then you get a Samaritan as the climax. Or you get the one who hides and doesn't take interest as the climax.
Biblical scholar John Dominic Crossan on Jesus and the power of parable. And we'll continue next week with another in this lecture series based on his book of the same title.